Morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 22nd of July, 2014. On the call today, we have Val Sherman, Tatiana Kramstova, Graham Bunton, Carlton Samuels, Steve Medalist, Chris Pelling, Sarah Wild, Roy Belise, Frank Mekulich, Paul McGrady, Justin Macy, Darcy Southwell, Phil Morano, Susan Kawaguchi, Todd Williams, Tim Ruiz, Griffin Barnett, and Alex Dinkin. We have apologies from James Bledel, Osvaldo Nuova, Christian Dawson, Holly Raich, Don Moody, and Don Blumenthal. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Marika Konings, and myself, Terry Agnew. And just joining us right now is Kathy Kleiman. I would also like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Graham.
Thank you kindly. So before we get going, that usual bit of business, does anyone have any updates to their SOI? Anybody? Nope. Okay, moving on. Any issues with today's agenda, which is, as I see it, going to be continuing our discussions on E1 and possibly getting to E2 if we have the time? Looking good. So let's maybe do a little brief summary. So we're still on Category E question 1, which is what, if any, are the baseline minimum standardized relay processes that should be adopted? We've had a bit of discussion on the list about this week, which has been excellent. Thank you, everybody, for participating. The way I see it, we're going to do a little bit of intro here. Talk about the minimum, and I think we might have some input there from Kathy and Steve. Hopefully a little bit later we're going to get to what happens if there's a failure in the relay communications that was discussed by, I think it was Alex and James on the list, and then maybe we'll get to hard copy that was raised by David too. So we've got some sort of meaty topics ahead of us. So Steve was suggesting on the list that we, and I want to make sure everybody's comfortable with this, that we the option to relay nothing is off the table, that their privacy and proxy services must relay something. And I think Kathy's addition to that she sent out early this morning, and maybe I'll get both of them to clarify here, is that sort of the minimum, and I think there's agreement on this, is that privacy and proxy services must relay all communications that are sort of required by the RAA or consensus policy within ICANN. Steve or Kathy, perhaps you could elaborate on those points?
Well, this is Steve. My point was just that a policy that says we won't forward anything would not be acceptable. I agree basically with Kathy that those things that are required to be sent to registrants should be forwarded, but I also think that bona fide complaints about abuse should be forwarded. So I agree with Kathy, as long as it's understood this is a minimum, but there are some additional things that should be required under the standard relay processes.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Kathy?
And, Graham, I think you got it exactly right, that the baseline minimum should include the forwarding of emails required under the ICANN rules to registrants. I just remember that there was a tweak that was discussed that meant that some of the proxy privacy service providers had already taken care of responding to some of this communication in their contracts and in their procedures. I'm not really sure how to reflect that, but just establishing the baseline minimum of the communication itself, this kind of routine communication, was what I was seeking. So thanks very much. I also think David Hughes had an addition as well. I don't know if he's on the call.
David, I'm not sure if David is either. I believe he was. Thank you, Kathy. I believe he was talking about hard copy. So we may get there. Hopefully, we'll get there. So from that, we've got that there's agreement that all the sort of RAA required notifications need to be sent out. Steve is suggesting that on top of that, any bona fide complaint should be relayed as well, and I'm not seeing any hands or any disagreement on that. So that sounds like there's, I think, reasonable agreement on that. Tim's raising in the chat, what does bona fide mean? Which is a good question. Do we have anyone who wants to speak to what bona fide might mean in this context? Steve does, and then we've got Michele. Please, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I'm using this in a very general sense that I think we've already agreed or we've had some discussion about steps that would be legitimate for providers to take to screen out harassing, you know, auto-generated submissions such as CAPTCHA, use of a web form. And I think we've also agreed that it's appropriate, if although not required, to have some type of spam filter. We might need to talk more about what that is. But I'm kind of going beyond that I think there should be an obligation to forward. You know, the presumption should be that the relay would happen. I'm not saying that necessarily providers would be required to manually look at these and decide whether they're bona fide or not, but I'm just talking about screening out through CAPTCHA and through spam filtering, but everything else should be forwarded. That's kind of my approach on this.
Thanks, Steve. If I can interject before I get to you, Michele, you did raise that on the list, and I think there seemed to be agreement from the last call that sort of implementation of spam and CAPTCHA was an acceptable limitation on relaying everything. Michele?
Yeah, thanks. I suppose from my perspective, what I'd be looking at is rather than defining what I would consider to be a genuine or legitimate or bona fide or whatever term you're comfortable with complaint, more what I consider to be an abusive complaint. We have one particular entity who sends us, I think on average, 500 complaints per day. All in relation to one or two domain names, even though we've told them repeatedly that what they're sending us is of absolutely no use to us, they keep on doing it. So from our perspective, rather than bothering our client with 500 spurious complaints every day, we just reject all the notices from that particular complainant because, I mean, in many respects, it's harassment. It's also incredibly stupid. So I think, you know, there is a line there somewhere. I mean, I'm not sure how one can clearly define the line. I don't know how we can do that. I mean, I think, you know, Steve mentioned on a few things there, and again, for the record, I find it odd that Steve and I actually agree on some of this. It's like, oh my God, hell's freezing over. But you know, the thing is that obviously, you know, I would assume that certain people know what the hell they're doing and aren't going to send a registrar in Ireland or a privacy service in Ireland something that they can't do anything with, and vice versa. I mean, I don't think that two cows would be particularly impressed if the local Garda sergeant from Carlow town appeared on your doorsteps. You wouldn't have a clue who the hell he was. And it's the same with anything else like that. So I think that's probably my way of looking at it. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. I'm not sure where the sort of upper bound fits that you're discussing there.
I don't know. That's the problem, Graham. I just think it's one of those things. It's like, you know, when you know it, you recognize it. When you see it, you recognize it. I think we need to be careful about being overly prescriptive in how you define it, because otherwise you'll see people just working around ways to circumvent it on both sides.
Thank you, Michele. This is Graham for the transcript again, in case someone missed me saying that. If I can put my registrar hat on for a moment, as Platos like to say, if there is an opportunity to abuse that relay service, it will be abused, as has been our experience anyway. So it is worth discussing and maybe thinking about, maybe it's a discussion for the list on what sort of constitutes that sort of upper bound, and I'd be very curious to hear other people's thoughts on that as well. That's enough for me. Kathy?
Hi, am I off mute, Graham? Okay. I wanted to agree with Michele, and I had actually gotten the cue to say something similar, which is that we should be setting a floor, not a ceiling, because I'm concerned, you know, harassment by divorce attorneys happens all the time in lots of arenas, including domain names, but just one of many. So this idea of letting the proxy privacy service provider decide when something's become harassment, I think is something we should leave for them. That call is being made in lots of other arenas. It should be made here too. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Registrar hat again for the moment is that I think you're probably right in that respect, that we see that sort of behavior and we're able as a registrar to identify it, and for the most part that works in the context where we see it. Anybody else on this particular topic before I think we're going to try and move on to relay failure as Alex raised it? I see another hand from Kathy and Steve, so let's go to Kathy, unless that's an old hand.
Sorry, old hand.
Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalis. Just to say, I feel reasonably relaxed about this as well, but I think we do have to recognize that there is also a capability to abuse this the other way and to decide that, you know, allegations of abuse are per se harassment or in some other way act in bad faith and not relay. I think we could probably come up with a pretty good formulation that recognizes that there's no way to completely anticipate this, but that commercially reasonable types of spam filtration and so forth are acceptable. I think if a registrar, I think we just need to leave open the possibility that if a privacy or proxy provider is kind of abusing that capability, that there would be a way to get a remedy for it. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. This is Graham. I suspect that if they were abusing that, it would be an issue for compliance, but I think we can clarify that a little bit more as we go forward. Anyone else? Yeah, Carlton's agreeing there. All right. So is Alex on the call? He is. So he was raising, how does the requester know of a failure to communicate with the registrant? And he was suggesting that there should be parity between the non-privacy and proxy world, where if they email someone from the Who Is information and they get a bounce, they know about it. Whereas if that occurs through a privacy and proxy service provider, that they don't know. And James responded, and he's not here, which is too bad, because I think he's quite well dialed in. And I'll see if I can characterize his response, and then we can discuss it a bit more. But anyone feel free to correct me if they think I've done so in a way that's not true to what James was saying. So what I think James was saying is that first bit where you're contacting, where you use that information in Who Is, that is for the privacy and proxy provider, you are communicating with the proxy service and not the registrant. And so if that fails, then that's a compliance issue. The communications between the proxy service provider and the customer, a third party has no, you know, right to access, to know whether that failed or not. However, if that communication is around a verified field under the RIA and it fails, then that would kick off a verification process again. And by looking at the domain 15 days later, you could know if it had failed or not. So I think that's the gist of what James was saying. Perhaps, Alex, you could elaborate, if you wouldn't mind, on your position. If I can put you on the spot. No, sorry, Alex, can't hear you. So Alex will dial in. We'll give him a minute. Does anybody else have thoughts on this particular topic around what happened if there's a failure to communicate with the registrant?
There's a question from Christina in the chat room.
I see that. Christina, you would know because the domain was suspended, so either it doesn't resolve anymore or the DNS has been changed to a notification page about that. It's not super precise, however, because unless it is this domain has been suspended due to failure to verify contact information, or if it just doesn't resolve, then it could have gone down for other reasons. So it's perhaps indicative, but not definitively indicative. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalis. I think I believe you've correctly characterized James's position, and I don't agree with it. I think that in the situation in which the registration is not a proxy registration, you know immediately if the email that you've sent to bounces back, for example, just to use that example. And so the idea that in 15 days you might find out, you would encounter a scenario, if you happened to check, that showed, that would at least be consistent with the email address not working, but might also be explained by a lot of other things, I just don't think that's a satisfactory substitute. We really want to, the goal here is, or what the third party is trying to do is contact the registrant, and I think it makes sense to put that third party in the same position, at least to know whether that the route he's tried has failed, and then he needs to try to find some other way. I don't see the justification for holding that information back. Now, I think in the dialogue that Alex and Luke had online, it may be that they were coming to convergence on that, I don't agree with James's position. And I think in response to Chris's question, in that situation where the email works but there's no response, that's a different situation. But until basically the third party doesn't know if they send something to be relayed and then get nothing back, they don't know which of the two scenarios applies. Is it something where the email is invalid and is bounced, or is it something where it's been received but there simply has been no reply? And I think we want to be able to allow the requester to distinguish between those two situations.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Alex, you want to give it a shot?
Yeah, can you guys hear me now?
We can hear you, thank you.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. Yeah, I think it's been summarized well while I was struggling to get my headset working. you know, I think the ability to know when something has bounced or a failure has occurred is important. And I just want to make sure that there is parity. I also don't agree or don't quite understand James' comment that that a requester has no right to know when something bounces. I don't quite understand that. Maybe I just don't appreciate it. But in the end, I think whether it's email and whatever form of email is implemented by the privacy proxy service, that if there is a known failure, then it should be returned to the original requester. And similarly, I think that should follow through for trying to contact via phone, although I understand that doesn't happen too often, but also with snail mail and postal mail. If there is a failure in that relay, then that should also be made known. So that's basically the point I was trying to make. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. Chris, did you have a registrar response there?
Hey, guys. Chris Pulling for the transcript. A couple of points, Steve and Alex, listening to that. I made a point last week in connection with how we will be handling our way of doing things, but reading, obviously, the left-hand side text boxes, it flicks up and down. There are going to be issues whereby you would email, as in... law enforcement or whatever service, will email the Privacy Protection Service. That may well be relayed, and Michelle mentioned this earlier. However, Gmail or Hotmail would or may well mark that as spam, in which case it would go straight to somebody's spam folder. Now, in that event, although we've done our part of handling that over, we confirm back to you that, oh, the mail has been successfully delivered, as an example, to... Oh, gosh, give up one of Gmail's long, funky server names. And at that point, you still don't get a response. What will that prove to you? At the end of the day, it proves nothing on the basis of you still don't receive a response back. You know, if it's a straight bounce, as I think Michelle was saying this earlier, it comes straight back under the RIA 2013 where... The contact is a failure and it bounces. And at that point, after 15 days, the domain is put onto a suspension page. My concern is here is we're not here to police this. The biggest problem is automated delivery systems, as an example, MTAs, message transfer servers. They will look at an email. And Spam Assassin does a very good job at this, unfortunately. They will look at an email and go, is it spam or is it not? Now, with servers doing that and therefore blocking content, at no point can any privacy protection provider or any registrar guarantee that the email has been put in front of a physical person to read. Just a quick point.
Thank you, Chris. Alex, is that a new hand?
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to. It is a new hand. I just wanted to respond to the point that Chris just made. I don't disagree. I think in the case where there is no privacy proxy in between the and there is no filter in between, sending emails off to a black hole. And a response is returned, the original sender of the message would receive the error back. Again, all I'm asking for is that if a bounce is returned or an indication of failure is returned to the privacy proxy service, that makes its way back to the original responder. You know, how email works and how filters complicate things, and I just want to make sure, again, that we have parity between the case where there's a privacy proxy service in between requester and the registrant.
Sorry, you broke up a bit there near the end, Alex, I think. Could you repeat that last part?
I just want to make sure that there's parity. I don't know where I broke up. I apologize. I want to make sure that if there is a... If the privacy proxy... service does receive an error response of any kind, that is relayed and made known to the original requester. I understand that there are services in between that may block that. That's the case whether there's a privacy proxy service in play or not.
Okay. Thanks, Alex. Tim raises an interesting point that this is worth thinking about, that how would this be verified or enforced? And I can't think of anything off the top of my hand. Volker, did you have something to add?
Yes. I mean, I look at such tickets from time to time that we get in the abuse queue and some of those that we get in the whois queue. And certain times, depending on how the mail server of the recipient is set up, we just get a mail back, your message could not be delivered. But we don't actually see which message this bounce message is referring to. So we might get a bounce message, but we have absolutely no clue which one of the hundreds of tickets that we just sent out over the day this actually is. So this may just, depending on how the mail servers of the recipients is set up, we might not even know which one has bounced and never be able to find out without putting in extraordinary amounts of work. So before we make this a recommendation, we should check for the realism of actually being able to give that information back.
Thanks, Volker. Was it, if I could get you to clarify briefly, it was Key Systems, I think, that does that has the scenario where you rotate the sort of random character string at your privacy service as part of the email contact info, and that only lasts 2 weeks, so you would need to be able to store a history of that sort of thing. So you've got this mechanism to prevent spam that might make it extremely difficult to track bounces back to the initial address it was sent to?
It really depends on how the message is set up. In some cases, where the encoded string is used for an email to the registrant, in most cases, the bounce would be sent back immediately to the sender because we only relay. But in some cases, the bounce message does not specify which messages it's referring to, and it just says your message could not be delivered, and it never says ID or subject or whatever might be helpful to relay that. And in such cases, we simply cannot relay. But yes, we do have a history, and the encoded string actually includes information on how and when the information was sent and who is the recipient. So, yeah, we have a history function for that.
Okay, thank you. Chris?
Hey, guys. Chris for the record from NetApp. The guy is actually... wrong word to use is making the argument, but for all intents and purposes, it's the discussion we're having. Making the argument about relaying and getting back responses, etc., etc. I'd like to put the cat amongst the pigeons, typical British term of asking a question. How exactly do you handle sending then a letter to a P.O. box in America that you get no response from and continue to get no response from? You don't get any receipt that the letter has been received. You may get a signature if you send it in the UK, it's called recorded delivery. But I'm just trying to work out the different avenues you're going to use to contact as somebody that may be on not using a privacy protection service, but you've sent your email, you've got no response or a bounce back, and you're now doing a letter. I'm just trying to work out from a privacy a proxy service, what do you then go on from there? Because obviously at that point, it's much the same as not getting any confirmation via email. That was the question that I'll stick out there and quick go to mute.
Thank you, Chris. Anyone care to respond to that? Christine is pointing out that U.S. Postal Service does provide delivery confirmation. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallis. I'm not sure if I understand the question, but I think there is a distinction in the P.O. box situation between sending something and never getting a response, or sending something and getting a stamp back from the post office says this post office box does not exist. That's really the distinction that we're talking about here. And I accept that there may be ambiguous situations where it's not clear that the message has bounced, but I think what we're suggesting here is that where it is clear that the message has bounced, the requester ought to know that. I think Luke pointed out online that in many cases that would be the case, but where it's not, I think that we're suggesting that it should be. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Michele?
Michele, for the record, my head's beginning to hurt. What exactly are we trying to do here? I mean, are we trying to rewrite communications protocols, or are we simply trying to set some kind of requirement that people can actually follow without their heads exploding? I mean, the thing is, you know, taking email is one of these things that, as a hosting provider, you realize very quickly that if I switched off our email servers, our phone system would probably melt, explode, or whatever, for the number of phone calls we'd get. Whereas if I turned off our web servers for half an hour, quite a few of our customers wouldn't even notice. And there is this kind of wonderful assumption that email works beautifully and wonderfully and smoothly all the time. But I mean, as others have noted, it's impossible at times to know what the hell is going on once an email has left your outbox. And I regularly get bounce messages from some ISPs, even though the mail has actually been delivered, which I find terribly confusing. Volker mentioned getting bounce backs that aren't at all clear, and we could spend hours talking about all the technical issues around this. But the question I have is, you know, at a much simpler level, without getting bogged down and giving us all massive headaches, what exactly do people want to achieve with this? Do you want something kind of thing that, okay, if the registrar or the proxy provider is made aware of or is knowledge of a problem with something, that they're meant to deal with it, or are you asking them to go off and go to all sorts of crazy lengths with little or no actual return? Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. I think you were close to what the ask is, and I'll see if I can characterize it like this, I think Mary was there also, is that, you know, if a privacy and proxy service has knowledge that a communication has failed, then they are required to notify the requester. And it's sort of, is that the sort of thing that we can include in our recommendations here? Alex?
Yeah. Thanks, Graham. This is Alex. So I think we're getting closer to what we're requesting. Clearly, just to go back to the question around postal mail, if in the case where no privacy proxy is in between and it goes to a P.O. box or whatever the equivalent is elsewhere, and there's no response, then we'd get no response. In the case where that happens between the privacy proxy service and the registrant, then again, I assume that the original requester would get no response. But I think if there is a failure that the privacy proxy service is aware of, whether it's email or postal mail or otherwise, then that should be returned. In the case of Steve's example there, where he says, you know, there's a specific error that says this postal or this person is not known at this PO box, and we should that information should be relayed. I think that's all we're saying. I'm not asking to, you know, create new communication protocols. That's clearly not within scope. I want to make sure that we get the information back in the case where there's no proxy involved.
Thank you, Alex. Sorry, there's a lot going on in the chat that I'm also having a bit of a tough time following, that as well as the conversation. So if there's something I need to highlight in there, please bring that to my We've got Kathy. Kathy, do you care to respond?
Hi, Graham. Hi, all. What I wrote into the chat, and thanks for the invitation to bring it into the oral discussion, is that I really like Steve's idea of using the term commercially reasonable. So as I understand it, a phrasing of that would be that the proxy privacy provider uses commercially reasonable means to deliver the email, you know, any of these emails that fit the categories that we've been talking about. That makes sense to me, that attempt to deliver. But any kind of response, I think, it sounds like it's going to be technically burdensome, burdensome in terms of staff and personnel, and perhaps impossible to pass on a response. And I think we're beginning to talk about huge numbers of emails that are going to be relayed through these systems. So let me throw the idea out there, and I don't even want to go down this path because I think we should really stop at commercially reasonable means to deliver. But when you get a return receipt in the U.S., you paid for it, and so I saw that floating around in the chat as well. Should those who are trying to send messages to be relayed pay for some kind of receipt if it's even possible? So thanks. Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Kathy. I saw that in the chat, too, and it's an interesting idea. I'm curious to hear other people's responses. I'd like to spend maybe a few more minutes on this topic, but we've also been dancing around the physical mail, snail mail aspect of this a bit, and so maybe we should cover that a bit more directly. So let's try and wrap this discussion up a little bit, and then we'll move on. Michele?
Yeah, thanks, Graham. Michele, for the record. Just on the commercially reasonable, just to make sure that we're clear, what would be commercially reasonable for Two Cows or for GoDaddy wouldn't be commercially reasonable, or may not be commercially reasonable for Black Knight or other registrars. I mean, this is a significant difference. I mean, how many staff does Two Cows have as a group? You're on the call, Graham, you can answer. You know, we have like 30-odd staff. Two Cows has, I don't know, hundreds of staff. There's a lot of differences in what's commercially reasonable for a small registrar or proxy provider and what's commercially reasonable for a very, very large provider. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. I'm going to let Mary jump in.
Thanks, Graham. And just before we move on, I think I'm just trying to go through some of these suggestions and capture them in notes. So going to first the commercially reasonable point, and clearly there's no problem with adding that. It seems to staff, though, that deals with the act of trying to deliver, and that would be what happens when the provider first gets the request and then tries to deliver it. It seemed to us that maybe Steve and Alex and others were talking about something slightly different, as in what happens after that if something is not delivered or undeliverable. Should there be some kind of at least partial obligation to report that, at least in a case where the provider knows that there was a failure? So it seems to us that the two points are slightly different, and that in our conclusion or preliminary conclusion, we might want to capture both flavors. So I just wanted to clarify that with you and the rest of the group. Thanks.
Thanks, May. I agree. Those are two distinct points. Todd?
Thanks. Todd Williams, for the record. I have been listening, and I just kind of wanted to try to simplify. I think I understand that the argument is that, it may be difficult to determine when there has, in fact, been a delivery failure. But I think Mary's point, which is, if you add something like knowingly, that in large part addresses that. What I'm not understanding is then, okay, say we have knowledge of a delivery failure. What is the argument as to simply notifying the original requester of that knowledge? And I don't know that I've necessarily got my arms around what the counterargument on that point is, especially given that, as I mentioned in my email, that little bit of information can be quite valuable to the requester. I know we've got to move on. I just wanted to put that out there. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd. Steve?
I know we need to move on. Steve Metallitz here, but just to say, my suggestion about commercially reasonable really applied to the use of filtering preventing harassment, not necessarily to delivery as a whole. I don't have a problem with commercially reasonable efforts to deliver, but I did use it in a different context. And I'd agree that what we're really talking about in the bounce back situation is whether it's known to the provider that delivery has failed. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I think we'll probably need to discuss this a little bit more on list. And there is also that idea floated that I haven't heard directly addressed around if the service provider is able to charge a fee for delivery receipts a la mail. So let's continue to think about those things. All right, Michele, I'll let you jump in there quickly.
No, sorry, just very quickly on the cost thing. I mean, just for those people who are actually on the call, I mean, you know, Steve and others, I mean, would you have a massive issue with us charging you a nominal fee for a notification if we were able to guarantee that we were to give you, I don't know, something back that you could use for whatever? I mean, do you find that completely offensive, or would you consider that would be reasonable? I mean, I honestly don't know, so I'm asking. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. Let's try and do this quickly, Steve, and then Todd, and then Kathy, and then maybe we'll...
This is Steve. I'll just give my quick response, which is, I mean, I'm really concerned about Tim's point in the chat. If it has value to the requester, then the cost recovery fee seems reasonable. That under that logic, you should start charging for who is, and you should start charging for anything that's of value to the public if you can find someone to pay for it. I just don't think that we should be going there. And my initial reaction would be, if you know it's bounced back, let the requester know, because you want to put them in the same position as if there were not a problem. You don't want to have them disadvantaged because there's
Steve, with all due respect, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking if, for example, I was to give you something more than simply informing you of a bounce back. That's what I'm asking you. I mean, it's like in technical terms, I can self-sign an SSL cert, but I don't have any guarantees with it because it's not signed by VeriSign or Komodo or whoever. So if I was to charge you, let's just say, a nominal fee, I'm not talking about cost recovery, but a nominal fee, and give you something much more than that, is that offensive to you, or is that something that you could consider? Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you for that clarification. We'll consider that. And I'm still not sure exactly what you're offering here, but let's pursue that.
Thanks, Steve. Todd, and then Kathy, real quick.
No, that's fine. I mean, I know we got to move on, and I would basically just agree with what Steve said. My point was more on just the notification. It sounds like what's on the table is actually something more than the notification, so I'll kind of reserve comment. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd. Maybe we can have Michele flesh that out a little bit on the list for us. Kathy?
Thanks, Graham. Just a quick point as we wrap this up, that somebody's going to have to pay for this service, which sounds like it's time-consuming. This type of response from what we're gathering sounds like it requires human intervention, it requires sorting through a lot of material, interpreting messages that aren't clear. Somebody's going to have to pay for it. So it's either the requester or the customer. So as between the two, we really have to think about it. I think it should be the requester. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kathy. So let's continue to have that discussion on the list. I'll see if I can push James to clarify his position as well, and we'll see if we can move that discussion forward there. Snail mail, hard copy, forwarding. David from the RAA brought this up on the list. And we do need to cover if there are minimum requirements for relaying physical mail. If you read through the responses from some of the privacy and proxy providers on the on the information that we've collected, then there's a number of approaches that people are taking. Quite a few people won't take any of it, some people won't take any of it. Quite a few people are doing where they'll scan and relay. We need to decide, I think, if there is a minimum requirement on physical mail. Volker?
Okay, personally, we do not, on our service, relay messages. We are not a mail forwarding service, and any communications can just as well be sent out through email, so we don't need a physical copy. And when we get a physical copy, I've personally lit my furnace with it, seeing that there was no way that I could, with reasonable effort, forward it to the complainant, to the registrant. We sent the complainant an email saying, please send it again. If you want us to forward it to the recipient, please send us an email, or even better, use the encoded email that's in the Whois. That way you will be certain that it reaches it, but we will not forward. In certain cases, we were not able to do that because the complainant did not include an email address. In such cases, we just throw them away.
Thanks, Volker. Someone should correct me if I'm wrong. And sorry, this is Graham as I speak for a moment. I don't believe that the physical address fields are verified under the RAA, which means physical mail may be less likely to get anywhere than email. So, Michele?
The 2013 RAA, the only things that can or could be verified under the contract would be either a phone contact or an email address. However, that doesn't mean that the physical address is necessarily going to be incorrect. I mean, that's like saying, 20 Christians on the call. How many of you have seen God? I mean, just because you haven't seen your God doesn't mean that your God doesn't exist. You know, that it's not a logical step to say that just because it hasn't been verified, it's going to automatically be wrong. Thanks.
No, I wasn't trying to suggest that it was by default incorrect. Just that it is potentially less reliable. Steve, you're saying there that David's suggestion was forwarding mail when electronic communications was failed in particular. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, I mean, this is Steve. Going back and looking at David Hughes' email, he said, when we've tried and we failed to communicate electronically, we're making another attempt through physical letter. So Volker's point was, you know, when he says he gets back to the requester and says, send an email to this, you know, to the address we've provided, this I think David is talking about a situation where that's already been tried. And maybe there's been a bounce back, or maybe it simply hasn't been a response. I guess it could be either. And I guess if we're not told if there's been a bounce back, then the requester wouldn't know which it was. But he's saying at that point, when the email address that the provider has given to the requester hasn't worked, should there then be an obligation to forward it on? So it's just in that case.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. The reality mail is interesting in that it's expensive to do. You know, it requires someone to open that mail and scan it as we do. And so there is a cost of that service, which I think was part of David's question. Do any registrars on the call have a sense of that cost, and or do we collectively think that we privacy and proxy service providers, I guess, in this case, are they obligated to do some sort of forwarding with mail, and is there a cost recovery mechanism that's amenable to the community? Chris, do you want to speak?
Chris, for the record, we looked at it from the point of view of the majority of complainees, is the wrong word to use, but you understand what I mean by it, that want to connect to a registrant, normally are law firms. And by the time you go through the fact you've told them you don't, or you are not the hosting company, you receive for essentially a ream of paper. By the time you sign for the document, open the packet, read the first 10-15 lines to find out what it's about, spend 10-15-20 minutes then prepping the scanner, getting it in the ADF, pressing the button, getting up the registrant record, getting the email address, physically scanning it to a PDF, sending the email, you're looking around about half an hour per document, depending if your ADF is quick enough, of course. At the end of the day, that comes to man hours. You know, if you're doing 10 of those a day, ideally that's 5 hours. On a cost basis, that's £500, £100 an hour. So, you know, you've got to consider that, like what we do as an example, we charge the sender. If they wish to send us a FedEx package up to 30 pages, they are charged $30. That takes for us to sign for the document, scan it, send it, provide back to the sender by email a letter signed by us to confirm that it's been delivered. And then obviously you don't find out who it was delivered to, but you do get from us a letter confirming it has been delivered. The cost basis is time, and in this day and age, like lawyers, you charge for your time, we must as well. That's it. I'll sign off.
Thank you, Chris. Any other responses to that? There we go. Steve, thank you. Please.
Yeah, this is Steve. I agree there's a cost involved here. But I think let's kind of look at what we know now. As we look through the template at the summaries of the terms and conditions of the existing services, I see that 1&1 Internet will forward and scan all first-class mail and mail receive reassertified mail or courier. I see that domains by proxy will forward certified or traceable courier mail or first-class U.S. postal mail, at least if they're legal notices. I see that Whois Privacy Service will forward registered mail or traceable courier. So, in other words, some hard copy material they will forward. In other words, a number of privacy proxy services seem to be doing this now. So this is, you know, obviously not everyone is doing it, there are cost considerations to be taken into account, but I just want to point out that a number of them say that they do this now as part of their regular business. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. As a registrar, we do scan and forward on registered mail and traceable courier packages as well. I will endeavor to go back to our compliance team and figure out what kind of volume that we see to get a sense of how impactful that is for us. I'll see if I can share that with the group. Michele?
Yeah, this is kind of not directly on this, but kind of related. I think one of the things we need to be very, very, very clear about and make sure that it is 100% clear, because I just see it as causing headaches for everybody, is, you know, there is no obligation on a registrant to respond, be that to an email or to a snail mail, notification. I mean, it doesn't matter what the notification is. It's a bit of communication. I mean, beside my desk at the moment, I have three letters that were sent to me in the last week or so by various companies that are trying to get us to buy products and services from them, and they somehow managed to get my name and everything else. I mean, I'm not going to reply to them. I'm under no obligation to reply to them. Sure, you send me a court order, you send me something which is legally obliging or legally binding on me, fine. Of course I'm going to take action. Of course I'm going to respond to it. But I just want to make it very, very clear that, you know, you don't want a situation where, let's just take, I'll pick on Microsoft or Google, that, you know, Google has to respond to every single spurious request that they get about, I don't know, domains or things that they host or that they have on a domain. I mean, it's just the concept of that kind of obligation scares the hell out of me. You know, that a privacy proxy service would need to relay something, make best efforts, commercially reasonable, et cetera, et cetera, and everything else, fine. But this, you know, the thing that worries me is any obligation for a response. Thanks.
Thank you, Michele. Really quick, Darcy. Thank you.
This is Darcy Southwell. I just want to say we have a couple different platforms, so we do it two ways, one of which, though, we do funnel everyone into No Mail, and they have to email us. And I guess I'm concerned that we're talking about requiring privacy proxy providers to allow for all methods of forwarding. If we have proper contact information that works as a provider, then we should be able to funnel everything into email. And it seems like we're focusing on having, and we haven't talked about phone calls today, but we talked about them last week, about how we need to handle all these different methods. And I'm concerned that we're not focusing on having good contact information and funneling it into a way to easily get it to the registrant, which is the focus. Thanks.
Thank you, Darcy. And I think that's a good point to end on. So I think we'll probably be doing a little bit more of E1 next week. Hopefully we can continue to have some really good discussion over the list, which was great to see some of that this week. I strongly encourage everyone to participate there again this week. And then hopefully we'll be able to dig into E2 as well next week. So thank you, everyone, for coming, and we'll see you again in a week, and Don should be back for then.
Thank you.
Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks, everyone. Terry, we can stop the recording.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, that does conclude the meeting for today. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines. Andre, if you can please stop the recording.
Okay.